The following interview was recorded on September the 11th, 2014. Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm your host, Dave Custy, for Arts, Music, and Culture in Baltimore. And my guest today is author Dan Fesperman. Dan Fesperman's ninth novel, Unmanned, was published this August by Knopf. Dan worked for the Baltimore Sun and the Evening Sun for more than 20 years, and his travels as a writer have taken him to more than 30 countries and three war zones. His novels of international intrigues have won two Dagger Awards in the UK and the Dashiell Hammett Award in the United States. He now lives in Baltimore with his wife, Sun reporter Liz Bowie, and their two children. Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio, Dan.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us a short bio in your words.
I grew up in North Carolina, in Charlotte. Went to the public schools down there during a pretty tumultuous time. It was all the court cases for school desegregation. So that was an education into itself to be there for all that. Went to University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm a loyal Tar Heel. I went into newspapers, moved around a lot, as newspaper reporters did in those days when jobs were plentiful. I worked at the Fayetteville Times, the Charlotte News, the Miami Herald, and then came up here to the Baltimore Evening Sun, and then moved over to the Morning Sun when I went to the Washington Bureau. And it was when I was posted abroad to Berlin that I first started writing my first novel. That would have been in the winter of 94 when I had just returned from the besieged city of Sarajevo during the Bosnian War. Mm-hmm. And was struck by so much there that a beginning came to me. And I also knew how I wanted it to end. And I dabbled a little in fiction before, just short stories, none published. And that was the first time I'd even thought about a novel and sat down and started writing it. And when I thought, hey, I can finish this. And it sort of went from there.
Let's go back a bit. We were in your Tar Heel at University of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Did you want to be a journalist then?
Yeah, I worked for the student paper. We had a daily, which was a real kick. We got to sit around, decide what was important and what to put on the front page, and run our own little newspaper every day. And I was in the journalism school there, and I had some great professors and a lot of good friends. And that's when I decided I really wanted to write for a living one way or another. I think in the back of my mind, I thought someday I'd like to try fiction. And I also thought someday I'd like to go cover some strife and conflict somewhere in another part of the world. So that was always in the back of my mind, too.
You worked with various newspapers, as you mentioned, and then you got up to the Sun and the Evening Sun. How did you find your way into Baltimore?
I had a friend who had come up here to the Evening Sun, Lou Leon, who had come up. She'd worked at the Charlotte News as well, and she and her husband had moved up. She'd actually come up here and then gotten married to a friend of mine from Charlotte also, who they both came up here. And so I knew about the place, knew about the newsroom, and had some contacts there. And when I was looking to leave the Herald, this was naturally came to mind, so I applied and got a job.
So what was your first impression of Baltimore when you came? What year was that?
I first came up here. I'm not sure what year that would have been. I first came here full time. That would have been in '84, January '84, when I joined the Evening Sun. And I had been here visiting them, my friends, before, mm-hmm. and really loved the place. I love the authentic feel of the place. I visited friends in Washington and always thought, like, well, there was a lot more glitz there and it was a lot more upscale, but it was a bit artificial, and people were coming and going, and it was a real influence town where people came there and just wanted to make so-called impact right away. And this seemed like a more down-to-earth place, and I liked that a lot, and I liked the neighborhoods. And I lived first in Bolton Hill. I got an apartment on the third floor mm-hmm. of an old row house there and enjoyed living in the city.
Well, what was the first thing you did when you got here? Do you remember what the first thing in terms of going out or eating or what have you?
I went out. The first thing I did when I came to visit my friends up here, we went out and got crabs one night. It was in the summer. Mm-hmm. And the same weekend, we went to an Orioles game, and that was a lot of fun. And I think we ate crabs on somebody's porch living up in right off of Keswick in Wyman Park, mm-hmm. that area, on a front porch, one of those two-story brick row houses right maybe a block from Wyman Park, Craycomb Avenue. So
you immersed yourself in what we are known for almost immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's terrific. When you first started at the Sun papers, what were you covering? You said you, went to Berlin, but before that.
Yeah, I was at the Evening Sun. I was a general assignment reporter at first, so I did a little bit of everything. And Evening Sun meant that you came in at about 7 in the morning because your first deadlines were very soon. And I was not a morning person, so it took some getting used to. I'd worked for an afternoon paper in Charlotte as well, but I was on the night staff most of the time there or in the Capitol Bureau. So I moved on. I eventually covered some sessions of the legislature in Annapolis. That was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that and did more general assignments and projects and moved to the Morning Sun's Washington Bureau. There was an opening there in 1990, I think it was, and I moved to that job.
When you got here, you had some assignments, but did you think that you would be here for 20 years?
No, I did not, because newspaper people are by nature restless
people. Nomads.
Yeah, and then it was pretty easy. As I said, the jobs were plentiful. You could move around. You could send your resumes. You could get your foot in the door in places, and they weren't all cutting back. Most of them were expanding, and so it wasn't that tough to get other jobs, but I liked it here. I settled in here. I liked the city. I met the woman who would become my wife in 1988. We got married. We just celebrated our anniversary yesterday, in fact.
Congratulations.
26, thank you. And we've got two kids now, so you start putting roots down in a place. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reasons I did was personal and the people I met, but it was also because I liked being here.
And you've stayed even though you're not in the sun anymore.
Stayed, although we did take 3 years abroad. We lived in Berlin from 93 to 96 when I was the bureau chief over mm-hmm. there for the Sun, when the Sun still had foreign bureaus. So.
Right. You know, off the top of your head, some like three assignments that you had when you were here that really have stuck with you, really meant.
One was a long project I did for the Evening Sun. It was about this unscrupulous home improvement firm that had not only did they do shoddy work and leave people with huge debts, they signed very low and often unsophisticated customers to second mortgages. Mm-hmm. And they ran all these second mortgages through these finance companies that they were operating, about four or five different ones, to try to disguise how many people mm-hmm. they were victimizing. Jeez. This way. And I just got huge breaks on that story. I got a printout of all their customers, and I discovered they held more than 300 and some odd second mortgages and were at one stage or another under foreclosure proceedings with all these people. And so I did an exhaustive story on it. It produced action by the Home Improvement Commission to put them out of business, which was good. But what it produced in the long term, a class action lawsuit by Billy Murphy, Luther West, another very do-gooder attorney from the University of Maryland mm-hmm. Law School, who was quite good at all this, and I'm kicking myself, can't recall his name right now, but they sued them. They got all 300 and some odd of these customers released from this mortgage debt.
Oh, really?
As part of the settlement, and I was very proud of that, having been able to trigger all that. So that was
terrific.
One. The other one would have been a story where I discovered a colleague of mine, Jeff Peters. He and I were doing a story. Everyone had done stories on the legislature and how people raised their money and where it came from and what special interest it came from. We decided it would be interesting to do a story on how they spent it on these small bore legislative campaigns. And we found a lot of interesting stuff about there was an insurance agent legislator who bought a lot of insurance policies from himself for his campaign.
Oh, really?
There were all these bizarre things, you know, people who had a wife who ran a florist shop, so they would send all their campaign workers flowers and, you know, charge it to the campaign. Mm-hmm. But the best thing I found was that there was a delegate, and he's back in the legislature, Nathaniel Oakes, who I saw all these hotel bills, pretty large, and I noticed they were all during the General Assembly session and conventions he'd attended, and they were all during the General Assembly session. And I thought, you know, this is when he's living here as a legislator. That stuff gets picked up by the state. And mm-hmm. so I went and looked up his legislative expense account, which was public record, and I found the identical expenditures, and this mounted up to some pretty good money. And he was double billing his campaign and the state for the same expenses.
Oh,
and I did a long taped interview with him where he tried to explain it away, not very artfully. And I ran a long story on that. And he was indicted within a very short period of time of that and was convicted of theft. And he did his sentence. I think he got probation and whatnot and was out of the legislature. And then as soon as that was up, he ran again and won again. So what can you do? But so I was proud of that one. I guess of that, the other would be just a long series of stories I did on daily life in Sarajevo when I was a foreign correspondent about what it was like to survive and try to lead as normal life as possible in the midst of living in a siege. And that inspired me to write my first novel. So that story was important to me a lot of ways as well.
Was that before or after Berlin?
That was while I was in Berlin. As the Berlin bureau person, I was responsible for covering the wars in Bosnia. Mm-hmm. And my first trip to Bosnia, in fact, was before I was even posted overseas. I went to central Bosnia. My first trip to Sarajevo, which was in the middle of the country, was right after I was posted in February of 94.
Mm-hmm. So you were in Berlin from 93 to 96. And what was it like when you first got over there?
It was
a big culture shock.
It wasn't culture shock, but it was just a fascinating place. We'd done a fair amount of travel to Europe before, so I was ready for that. I was ready for living there. What was interesting was East Berlin was still looked very much like it had when the wall was still up. Mm-hmm. The wall had come down in 89. Reunification had been in 90. We arrived in July of 93. So it hadn't been quite 3 years since the wall had – or 4 years since the wall had gone down in November of 89. And East Germans were still very wary of reunification because they'd had as bad as and as terrible as things were with that informer culture that they had developed under the Stasi. They also had, economically at least, some security. They had guaranteed place to live. They didn't really have to work very hard. They had certain protections under the government. So they'd gotten that in exchange for this horribly repressive regime that snooped on them everywhere. Mm-hmm. But so it was a fascinating time, and it was interesting to see East Berlin because parts of it looked just like the war had just ended in 45. Scarred up buildings, bullet-pocked, bomb-pocked, some of them with the backs off of the buildings still and open to the elements. They hadn't done very much repair to some parts of the city even since 45.
Did that have any influence on your next novel?
It had influence on a book I wrote later, The Arms Maker of Berlin, about where I had a character flashing back to his life as a teenager during the war, yes.
Do you speak German? Was that difficult?
Ein bisschen Deutsch, not very much. And I didn't speak it great. I spoke it okay when I was there, although doing interviews I still felt more comfortable with an interpreter along with me. Mm-hmm. And what German I had has, I haven't really used it since 96, so it's been, 19 years? So it's going on 19 years. It's kind of dwindled away. I don't have very much.
You brought your family over there, too.
Yeah.
What was it like for them?
My son had just been born. He was 3 weeks old when we moved, and my daughter was only three. So my son doesn't really remember much of anything. He was three by the time we came back, and my daughter was six. My daughter remembers a little bit more. She had some friends she made. What was sad was she was a fluent German speaker by the time we left, and my wife and her went to visit some friends of theirs a year later. But, of course, in a year, when you're 6 years old, you gain language quickly, you lose it quickly. And she got off the plane, and her friends were at the airport greeting her in German, and she just burst into tears because she'd forgotten it all. She was like, Mommy, what are they saying? So it comes and goes quickly at that age.
And your wife, how did she adapt?
She liked it a lot. She was on leave from the sun while she was over there, and she basically took 3 years off and got to spend more time with our kids and made some very close friends there.
You mentioned Sarajevo. Go into a little detail about what was that like.
It was pretty frightening at times because the unpredictability of it. The shelling and the sniping, it was kind of like the weather. You would have bad days and good days. You'd have days where there was very little shooting. You'd have days where it seemed like there was a shell dropping every 2 minutes, and you didn't know where it was going to land, so you had to be very careful and you were on edge. I'd never been any place like it, and I've never been any place like it since, and I doubt I will. It was a surreal atmosphere of people trying to go about their lives as normal as they could, even though 10,000 of them lost their lives to shelling and sniping over about a 3-4 year period.
So how long were you over there? Did you go back and forth?
I went
them?
Several times. I went to Bosnia probably a dozen or so times. Mm-hmm. I would stay anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks usually, sometimes less, and I would go to different parts of the country. I think I went to Sarajevo 4 or 5 times. I also went there after the Dayton Peace Agreement when it was a much changed place already.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how did it progress in your
I haven't been there since then, and this was only months. I went there after the Dayton Agreement and even a little beyond that, but people were very relieved it was over, but they were very changed, too, and there were a lot of emotional scars still. But
I'm sure you were changed, too. I mean, how did you...
I was changed.
How was your perspective afterward?
I'm not one of those people that... I absorb all this stuff, but I'm not one of those people that internalizes it a lot and just can't get over
good.
It. Yeah, well,
you
got
to go to all sorts of places.
Yeah, you could call it callous. You could call it a defense mechanism, but
or journalism.
It was yeah, and if you internalize too much of it, you know, it would have been hard. But the only effect it had on me in aftermath usually was I would sometimes wake up from very vivid dreams and would be convinced when I woke up, even though I'd be in Berlin, that I was either in the field or in some place that was under attack. And I would kind of be on edge and think, all right, where am I? What do I have to do? What's going on here? But it would last for about 5 seconds. Then I'd come to my senses and say, all right, I'm in bed. I'm in Germany. Everything's fine. So,
what about other places? Where you covered?
As the Europe correspondent, I was the backup to the correspondent in the Middle East. And our foreign editor was a former Middle East correspondent. So when news got hot there, which was fairly frequent, he liked to have me fly down there and double up on stories. So when the Oslo peace agreement came along in late 93, I went down there for about 3 weeks to Jerusalem. And Doug Strzok was the Jerusalem bureau, a very good correspondent, great writer. And a pleasure to work with when I would go down there. So I probably spent 2 or 3 months total in the Middle East during my 3 years covering Europe. I was down there when Baruch Goldstein, this right-wing Israeli settler, opened fire in a mosque and killed something like 29 Arabs while they were praying. I was there when after Rabin was assassinated. I was there... quite a few times because it was I was there when Arafat returned to Jericho in the wake of the Oslo Accords. I filled in for the correspondent when he went on home leave. That was for about a 5 week period at once. So, and that was at the end of that, in fact, was when Arafat returned.
Yeah, well, I guess you can't let that internalize all that either.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was interesting, and especially with Gaza being in the news recently. Right. I took quite a few trips to Gaza, and it was a fairly benighted place even then.
I lived abroad for 10 years myself, and I talked to people who have and asked them, basically, if people from America lived abroad for a while, I think there would be a completely different perspective of things in terms of about...
To see firsthand that the way we do things here, it's not the only way to... It's not the only good way to do things, either within a democracy or within our economic system. You hear a lot of people, especially Republicans, commenting here about, well, that's like Europe, that's like Germany, that's a nanny state and all this. But actually what you see, what we saw living in Germany was that if you had a full-time job there, you had a living wage and you had health care.
Right.
And even if you were working in a shop, you could support your family on what you earned from working 40 hours a week, and you weren't forced to work part-time, and you weren't forced to take no benefits. And were your taxes high? Well, yeah, they were high, but you got something for it.
Mm-hmm.
You got insurance that if you're working, you're going to be able to support yourself. And there was a lot to be said for that system, and you can call it a nanny state all you want, but these people were not coddled. They were working. You know, they were working full-time jobs. So there's that, and there's also... oddly enough, and I think because of how Germany, because of all of the guilt from World War II, there was a real sensitivity to inclusiveness. Now, you still had some unreformed jerks from different parts of the country of a certain age who probably needed to be controlled by all these new laws they had in Germany. But you had a lot of people who were extremely tolerant and open to new things and open to different people. And even though Germany had a lot of problems with this, you know, hatred against asylum seekers and things like that, it was also a very tolerant society. We knew a couple of interracial couples, for instance, who said it was far easier living there in Berlin, because Berlin was a very tolerant city, than it would have been living in the U.S., where they had more problems traveling around. So it was interesting to see that.
I think it really shapes a person when they travel.
Yeah, and it stretches you, I think. It stretches your point of view. It stretches your willingness to
So you don't see people just as one thing.
Yeah,
just,
it gives you a more open mind, I think, when you live in other countries and other cultures.
We talked about you as a writer in your journalism business. Now let's talk about your books. How did that arise, your first one?
Well, that first one arose, as I mentioned, after I got back from my first trip to Sarajevo. I got a character in mind. I had done a story there on law and order and how the criminal justice system continued to try to stumble along even though this horrendous siege had enveloped everyone. And so I got this idea of a homicide detective trying to keep his sanity, trying to keep himself alive and safe, yet still trying to solve these little murders that were occurring even in the midst of a siege. And so I got that in mind and couldn't shake it, and so I started writing it. And that led, one thing led to another, and I enjoyed doing it. By the time I'd finished my third, I went on book leave for my third book, which was set in Afghanistan and Pakistan, based on some of my experiences there for The Sun. And after that one, I came back from book leave for a couple of years, and then I went full-time. I was able to get a good enough contract to basically leave The Sun for good in 2005.
And so you worked for The Sun for a while, for a couple books, and then...
Yeah, and that was hard doing it at the same time. I'd have to get up at... My schedule when I was writing books and working at The Sun, I'd get up at 6 in the morning. I'd be writing. I got it to where I could be actually working, functioning... coherently by about 6:15 with that first cup of coffee, and I learned to wake up quickly. And I was writing by 6:15, and by about 9 o'clock it'd be time to go into work at The Sun, and I'd put in a full day and sometimes evening there, and then I'd come on home and drop off to sleep pretty quickly after a day like that.
Mm-hmm. What did your family think of?
My wife was very tolerant, and she was working at The Sun, too, and she was great about giving me that morning time to myself.
Mm-hmm. How did you arrive at the other ideas for books? So just kind of give me a little progression. You don't have to go into
I've never had trouble coming up with ideas. I always have one in mind, at least, before I'm finished with the other one. And that gestational period usually starts when I'm about three-quarters finished with that one. So the second one, I wrote it with the same character, the Bosnian detective, and it focused more on war criminals, past and present. The third one, I had been sent, while I was working on that second book, I got sent to Pakistan and Afghanistan about a month after 9/11 in 2001. And so I knew that from everything I was seeing and experiencing there that that would provide me with the book. And so I had that in mind and then came back and finished my second book and then started on that book. That's the one I took the first leave for. Before I was finished with that one, I came up with the idea that I wanted to do a book set at Guantanamo. So I went down there for a few days and got the cook's tour and talked to a lot of people who'd worked there as interrogators and whatnot after I got back. It's just,
They just kind of flow.
I will get an idea, as I said, while I'm working on the previous book, and then I'll start to think about it some as just before I start to pull away from that last book when I finished it.
So. Do you get most of your ideas in that time in the morning, or is it all over?
It's hard
it
to say.
You.
It's all over. It
no,
hits
I know. It's just
different things trigger
thing.
Them, too. Yeah. Different things trigger them as well.
Let's talk about the current book, Unmanned. Tell me a little bit about that.
That's a book I came up with. It's I'd seen a news account about drone pilots. This was probably 2010, and it was 2010, and because that's when I first went out to talk to some of these guys. I'd read a news item, and what first captured my interest was this whole idea of these suburban warriors, these guys who, by day or by whenever they happen to be working, some of them on the overnight shift because those shifts rotate, they would go out to this Air Force base in the Nevada desert, about 40 miles outside of Las Vegas, and they'd go inside a little trailer, sort of like these mobile trailers where they put kids in classes when your schools are overcrowded. And it'd sit in this heavily air-conditioned trailer to protect all the electronics in there and sit before four video screens and two manual keyboards and a stick and a rudder. And they'd have sort of a co-pilot or a sensor next to him. He'd have a similar array of equipment. And they'd be flying these drones that were 7,000 miles away and nine time zones into the future. So they'd be looking intently into this other world and, in effect, into the future. And then they'd be, at the end of the workday after doing this intense job, they'd be driving home to their families in the suburbs. So where they really
detached,
yeah, where they really couldn't talk about anything that they did at work because it was all secret. So
they could leave it all there.
Yeah, they couldn't leave it all there. That was the problem for a lot of them. But they would, in name at least, have to. So they'd be going to their daughter's soccer game or their son's baseball game or a barbecue in the backyard, worrying about things like the sell-by date on the milk they were picking up on the way home, and completely, you know, going back and forth between this every day. And I thought that there's a road to weirdness and depression and stress. And it is. They have a high burnout rate. But what struck me even more once I actually got to talk to some of these people who did this was this strange, weird blend of intimacy and remoteness, which the job itself entails. Mm-hmm. Meaning they sit and watch maybe under surveillance. They might be looking at some little Afghanistan village and the life in it. 20, 30 people, all the characters. They might be watching that closely, intently, very carefully for a day or two at a time. And they start to get to know characters in it. You know, they can't hear them speak. They can't recognize faces, but they can see the way people move. They can see how they're dressed. They can see where they live, you know.
They're almost right next to
it. Yeah, it's like their neighbors watching with a telescope from an attic window. And, you know, you can see the old guy going out to the field. You can see the mother with her kids digging onions and then the kids going off to play cricket. You start to recognize who lives where and all of that. And then at the end of this, maybe you get an order. Well, we've got intelligence that we need to blow up that third house on the left. And it's pretty appalling. Mm. You know, you've got this close intimacy and all of a sudden now you've got to do this. And that's bad enough. You get to sit there and watch it happen. And then you got to go through the damage and make sure you've gotten the people you wanted to get. So you're going through that for hours, looking at it very closely, the results of what you've done. Whereas when you're a fighter pilot, and some of these guys were F-16 fighter pilots who got yanked out of their squadrons and put on this, that Xbox shit, as they called it, they didn't like it very much, especially the ones who weren't in it. And you got put on this, and so all of a sudden, you know, before you were flying around, you might fire a missile at another jet, and you might hit it and destroy it, but probably not see it when it blew up. You'd know it from the readout on your in your plane. You might fire a missile at some target on the ground, but you wouldn't hang around to look at it. You know, that would be done by your computer on board or whatever, and you might look at that later, but only for a second or two. So it's this up-close and personal relationship with people that you just might have to kill, or up-close and personal relationship with, say, U.S. units of soldiers who you were in charge of protecting. And if they got chewed up in a ground attack, it might be partly your fault because you didn't see the danger coming. So it's a very high-stress, high-tension job where you're not getting the thrill of actually flying. You're not getting that release also of being at risk. Mm-hmm. Your biggest risk is climbing into the car for the commute back home and having to dodge Vegas traffic when you get there. So you didn't get any of those releases or those compensations. And then to top it all, you're in the burbs. You're not on deployment where everybody is sharing your experience. You're going back home where no one knows what you're up to and you can't really talk about it. So it's a job kind of guaranteed to be a pressure cooker and to make people crack.
Right, like intimacy, like you said, and isolation.
Yeah, and so that's the kind of character I decided I wanted to build, is someone having to deal with that, this strange new job, a job, there's never been any job like it in the military, this ultimate reconnaissance weapon, yet at what price for the people who have to operate it?
Tell us a little bit about Cole.
Darwin Cole is, he's run one of those missions where he had to blow something up, where he realizes he knows all these people. He didn't realize it at first, but he realizes as they're about to fire their missile that, wait a minute, I know this village. I know those kids who just ran out of the building 2 seconds before our missile hit while we watched. And he also knows at some level that something's wrong here. Maybe those kids shouldn't have been there. Something isn't right. He's not sure why, but it's something from a previous mention a month before where he reconned the same place. And but the experience is so tough for him to get over that a year later we join him again, and he's living by himself out in the desert. His family has moved off back to Michigan, where his wife was from. He couldn't handle the pressure. He couldn't handle the aftermath. He's washed out of the Air Force with a dishonorable discharge, and he's basically a drunk living in a trailer by himself out in Wile E. Coyote territory out in the Nevada desert.
Mm-hmm. And so, not to give it away, yeah, but tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, he's approached by some journalists, by some freelancers, and they're only freelancers because their newspapers are dissolving around them, so they've all taken buyouts. And they've all kind of latched on to this story. They've discovered each other's fingerprints and footprints on this same topic, and so they've decided to join forces, which works for them as freelancers economically, and try to get a good magazine piece, maybe even a book, about what they think is a rogue, or at least an off-the-rail CIA agent who has, because of bad intelligence provided by him, some of these missions, like Darwin Cole's, came to a bad end. And they go to Darwin Cole. They said, "We think we know, you know, who's behind what happened to you. Would you help us out?" And Darwin Cole thinks, well, he's a little wary of helping him. You know, there's a lot of mistrust between the military and journalists. But he thinks, well, maybe this is my ticket out of here. Maybe this is my ticket back to a life of some purpose. Maybe if they'll agree to not just let me give an interview, but actually work with them, help them, I can get to the bottom of what went wrong, and I'll be at peace at least a little bit more, because I'll know what happened and why it had to happen, my mission and the way it failed. So he strikes a bargain with him. Look, I want in on this. They're wary of him because journalists like to do things on their own terms. But they realize that he can not only offer his story, he can offer other contacts which will help them. He can offer access that they might not have to other items and other information which otherwise they wouldn't be able to get. So they take this bargain and they begin working together to try to find out what really happened.
Sounds wonderful. It's gotten a good review from the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. Review. It just came out in August, is that right?
Yeah, it just came out in mid-August, yeah.
What are your plans in terms of marketing it?
Well, that's usually up to the publisher. I've done some online. It's amazing now. It's changed so much, even since I first started writing books. The moment word goes out, you have this new book and your publisher puts the word out, you start hearing from either the Huffington Post or other websites, and they all want you to write content for them, which, of course, free content. But it's like, here's the deal. Well, you can market your book. You can get yourself some attention, and we'll mention that your book is out, and you'll write us maybe a column about or an essay or a blog item about drones or some aspect of drones. That's a hot topic. Or we want you to do a Q&A. And I enjoy doing Q&As like this one where I just come in and answer questions, because it's not like I have to sit down and think all that much. I just answer the questions. And
it's stuff you already know.
Online, how it often works is we'd like to send you a dozen questions and have you answer them. Well, already it's tougher because you're writing, and you write for a living, so you don't want to come across as an illiterate idiot. Maybe answering questions, if you sound like an idiot, you can at least say, well, you know, it was on the fly. What could I do? I'm not the greatest, most articulate speaker of all. But when you're writing them, there's no excuse. So you have to be pretty careful, and you spend a lot of time doing these things. I think I totaled it up the other day. I've done 6 or 7 Q&As. I've done four either blogs or columns or essays for one group or another, either here or sites in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a small speech for a group that I went to talk to, and I don't want to take that lightly, so I did that. I figured I've done about 4 solid weeks worth of work just writing free stuff for other outlets, for which you hope it helps your book, but yeah, who knows whether it does.
But that's
or
about
not.
The time it's been out, though,
but
right?
That's about the time it's been out. And that's, you know, this has taken me away from my current project. It's basically cost me a month. And it also, when you go away from a project like that, you have to spend at least a week getting back into it. And I've had to leave it behind 2 or 3 times now. So it's really disruptive to what you're working on, and
that's what you got to do today. Huh?
That's what you have to do today, because there isn't a whole lot of advertising money. There's not much. Knopf doesn't spend a whole lot of money on touring anymore. because they figure it doesn't pay. And I think they're probably right, unless your name is, you know, John Grisham or somebody like that who will get huge crowds wherever they go. So it's hard. It's a good question. How do you market a book like that? I really don't know. So
how is your audience abroad? I mean, won awards in the UK.
Yeah, it's if you won book or another, I figured it out. I've been translated into, now I can't remember if it's 9 or 10. Nine or ten languages. But different books have gotten.
Is German one of them?
German's one of them for my first book, for Lie in the Dark, and also for a couple of later ones. I can't really remember which ones. Not, I don't think, The Arms Maker of Berlin, although maybe. Maybe. I can't remember which is which.
Some
the first
there.
One got translated into Japanese, which is a fun book to own because it's all written backwards and it's all I can't understand a word of it. And one's in Greek, one's in Russian, one's in several have been in, about 5 or 6 have been in Dutch. There's a publisher there who seems to like the books a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And other languages, a couple in French, a couple in Spanish. In Spain with a good publisher over there in Madrid. Yeah, it's been interesting whenever that happens. It's always fun to get that book in the mail.
That's funny. That was my next question. Yeah. Has this been fun for you?
Yeah, a lot of fun. It's a great job. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I really enjoy being a foreign correspondent. That's my second mm-hmm. favorite job because basically I was allowed to be an intrusive tourist barging into people's lives and asking questions that you never get to ask as a tourist in different places all over the world and really get to sink in deep to cultures mm-hmm. in different places. And I loved that. And doing this job, I set my own hours. I write about what I want to write about. And I get up every morning knowing I'm going to be able to do something I enjoy doing. So even though writing itself can be stressful at times and you get stuck. I've never had what I'd call writer's block, but mm-hmm. You get stuck and you feel stale at times, but you move on. And I really wouldn't, as I said, I wouldn't trade it for another job except possibly being a point guard for the North Carolina Tar Heels, but that's never going to happen. No. So, yeah.
But I won't dash your dreams.
Though. Yeah, that's yeah, yeah. never had the stuff for that. So.
Michael Jordan time, maybe.
I could my vertical leap is slightly less.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's it's very modest. So let's talk about what you're working on now.
Okay. I'm working on a book set in, it's a departure. It's set in 1942 Manhattan. And a couple of reasons I'm working on that. One, I'd gotten this idea years ago and thought someday I'd like to write about that. And then the opportunity presented itself when my wife, a reporter at The Sun, got a fellowship at Columbia University a couple of years back. She's an education writer. And she got a Spencer Fellowship at Columbia to take basically an academic year and unwind and not be doing daily journalism, but mm-hmm. to work on a long project. Her proposal was part of her application for the grant, where she was going to do a long piece, an interesting piece on the advanced placement program and how it's used or misused by schools. And Columbia awarded her this fellowship. It gave her a stipend, and we got a university-subsidized apartment. And so we went up there and lived for 9 months and went back and forth between our home in Baltimore and there. And it was a great opportunity. I was working on...
Did you live like in the Upper West Side?
Yeah, we were up in Morningside Heights, mm-hmm. right on Riverside Drive. In an apartment.
I used to live on Riverside Drive.
Yeah, it's very pleasant and very quiet, too, living in that neighborhood. And so we got to live there 9 months, which was a whole lot of fun. I got to see an Orioles playoff game at Yankee Stadium in 2012. Yeah. Had a great time, but it gave me the opportunity once I'd finished Unmanned. I was working on that, finishing it while I was up there. But I finished it with about 3 months left in our 9 months there. And so I took that 3 months and I did a lot of research that you can only do in Manhattan at certain archives mm-hmm. and libraries, and talking to people about what it was like in Manhattan in 1942 during the Second World War. And awful lot of fun, awful fascinating material. And so that's what I'm working on now. I've written about 220 pages and I'll probably finish it in late November.
How do you see yourself in terms of, this is a question I ask everybody, but it's different for authors because usually it's just, well, I get another idea and for another book.
Yeah.
But I ask about 3 months or 5 years down the road, but You're going to just continue what you can do, right?
Yeah, I'll continue what I do.
I'm not going to be a point guard.
I'm not going to be a point guard or a power forward.
That was the other dream, huh?
That was the other one, but it's pretty limited. It's pretty unrealistic. But I may do a little script work. I've done a little work with the incomparable David Simon and Ed Burns. Mm-hmm. We were working on a TV project for a while. Right now, that's kind of in limbo. But I wrote a couple of teleplays with them. It's a very collaborative venture. So when you say I wrote a teleplay, it's basically, even though your name might be on it, it's collaborative work. The three people in that case were doing it once, and it's a great atmosphere. You get tons done in a short period of time that you'd never get done on your own. And so maybe that will go somewhere, maybe it won't. But I may get an opportunity to do more script writing. My first book, Lie in the Dark, has been optioned for British television.
They have
a playwright that's writing about a 3 or 4 episode miniseries based on that. The long range plan is, if that succeeds, they'd like to do more with that character. And if that happens, then I may be involved with some teleplay writing on that. But that's, you know, that would be well down the road. Mm-hmm. So there may be more work of that nature in the future as well. And I enjoy it, and it's fun. And it's kind of a break, too, in the sense that you're working all day by yourself. And while I enjoy working on my own, and it's very productive, it's fun to break out and work collaboratively, too, mm-hmm. on another project.
Do you see Unmanned as a movie or a teleplay?
My film agent does, and she says she's getting a fair amount of interest. I guess film agents, that's part of their job, is saying that to writers to keep them happy.
Keep you stroked. Well.
Right, but I do believe that there is some interest on it, and I wouldn't be that surprised because it is a pretty hot topic right now. So who knows? Maybe it will sell, maybe it won't. And if it sells, maybe it'll be produced, maybe it won't. A previous book optioned twice, my second novel, and then those options eventually expired when the producer, Kennedy Marshall, couldn't get the director they wanted. They wanted a Bosnian director who was hot at the time, and he just couldn't arrange his schedule. Mm-hmm. And so that unfortunately fell by the wayside.
It's the nature of the game.
That is the nature of the game. But if they want to keep sending option payments for no work at all, I'm fine with signing them. So
I read once that there are Hollywood writers that made an entire living out of doing something and didn't get one thing produced.
Yeah. It's a strange world. It's you think that book publishing pays pretty well sometimes, and it can, but it's a whole different scale in Hollywood where they mm-hmm. will write you a check that they think is chump change, and is to them, which you think, hey, that's half a year's college tuition.
Yeah, there you go. So, it's always nice.
Yeah, and if you're writing books, you're thinking, that's fine. Just send me some more chump change. So.
Well, this has been fun. I've had a great time.
I have too.
It's terrific. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, I covered a lot. Thank you very much.
This is just an introductory. I'm just going to kind of flightly through your career and everything like that, and I would like it if you came back and updated us.
Okay, be happy to do that.
Okay, would you like to give out some contact info?
You can reach me at you can find my website is the best way to reach me, mm-hmm. actually, at www.danfesperman.com. I also have an author site on Facebook under my name, and those are the best ways to reach me.
Well, what we'll have is a link for this interview, and it'll be on my website.
And I'm sure I'll be linking it to
mine. And I'll give it to you, and so you can see it through that because it'll be archived.
Okay.
And it'll be attainable 24/7, but it also will be in the rotation 24/7. So I'll let you know. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
I've been talking to author Dan Fesperman, and his 9th novel, Unmanned, has just been published by Knuff. And this is Dave Custy, and thank you, Dan, again.
Thank you.
And this has been Arts, Music, and Culture in Baltimore, and this is Baltimore Internet Radio.